These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be a chat about the origins behind some more popular sayings. We're heading back to the sayings buffet for another helping here, mate. Although I will say it has been quite a while since the last time we tucked in. Episode 130, get across it. Back in the good old days. Back in the good old days of what was it? December 2020. What a time that was. But in that episode, in the historic origins of popular sayings part one, we talked about sayings like fiddling when Rome burns, or the concept of a red herring, or the saying hoist with his own petard. So a lot of very interesting stuff in that episode, and a lot of very interesting stuff in this one too. We've got sayings lined up like mad as a hatter, bite the bullet, crocodile tears, I've got a bridge to sell you, and a baker's dozen. We'll get across the origins of all of these sayings and, not anymore. I was going to say all these and more, but there's not more. In fact, it's that's it. That's all five. But that should do us, right? Anyway, before we begin, I want to thank not a specific listener this time, like I normally would, who's gotten in touch to suggest. Although I'm obviously very deeply appreciative of all the people who've gotten in touch suggesting topics throughout the last week or so. Now I want to thank the many hundreds of listeners who have headed on to TikTok and Instagram to follow the brand new Half-Assed History social media channels. Thank you so much to everyone who has liked, commented, and subscribed. And I wanted to add that after a lot of thought, quite seriously, I did have to really ponder this one, I've actually decided to get back onto Twitter as well, or X as it is these days. So you can head to twitter.com/halfassedhistor. No Y, wouldn't fit. Very annoying. And you can follow me there as well. And if you like, right, as a special little treat for anyone who heads over to my old Twitter account, you can actually scroll down through I've just converted it to the Half-Assed History account. It used to be my former personal feed, right? I haven't used it for a couple of years. But if you scroll down, you'll find out a whole bunch of stuff about me that you might not have known if you're a more recent listener. Older listeners may know some of the stuff that I used to and still get up to. But it might be interesting for you to discover some details there. I don't tend to talk about myself or the other stuff I've got going on here on Half-Assed History. So there you go, a bit of a peek behind the curtain for you, including something as basic as what I look like, which seemed to be a surprise to a lot of listeners on TikTok and Instagram based on the comments they left there. I don't know what you thought I was going to look like, but just an average looking brown haired man with a moustache. I think it was the moustache that threw a lot of people. Anyway, we'll have more social media chat at the end of the show. For now, let's get stuck into this week's episode and get across the origins of more popular sayings. Here we go. We're going all the way back here. We're going all the way back to, where should we start with our first saying? 1865, I guess, not where it originated, but perhaps when something came along to help it help it become a lot more famous than ever, actually. You'll be familiar with this phrase, mad as a hatter, probably due to the personification of this saying in popular literature with the character of the Mad Hatter in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by the famous weirdo Lewis Carroll. This book, however, is not the origin of the saying. We don't call someone mad as a hatter because there was a character called the Mad Hatter in Carroll's book. There's a character in Carroll's book called the Mad Hatter because of the saying. It's actually the other way around. Now, this is not a controversial statement. I'm not, you know, nailing my colours to the mast on something that's going to see me excoriated by people who know better here. Because, very simply, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was published in 1865, as I say, while the earliest recorded usage of the phrase mad as a hatter goes all the way back to 1829. So there's no debate about it. There's no debate to be had about Carroll coining the phrase. He didn't. But if the term didn't come from Carroll, where did it come from? Well, there are a few different theories, and some of them are optimistic, I would say, but one holds a little more water. We'll do that one last. Let's get across some of the other ones to begin with. Firstly, there's the theory that it's linked to a bloke by the name of, it's a spectacular name, Roger Crabbe, who lived in 17th century England. Now, Roger Crabbe was a roundhead initially. He fought for Oliver Cromwell in the Parliamentary Army. But then he stopped being a roundhead to instead make round hats for people's round heads. He worked as a hatter for a while, but then later on in life, he took up veganism. And let's remember here, we're talking about a bloke in the 17th century taking up veganism. It's hard enough to be a vegan these days, even with supermarkets and restaurants catering to veganism with, you know, all these vegan-friendly options that you see. But back in the 17th century, Crabbe, he did not have a lot of options. He mainly ate potatoes and carrots and bran and turnips and not much else. Apparently, he even ate grass sometimes, according to the man himself, which can't have been much fun. But in addition to his veganism, he also became an ascetic. He gave all his stuff away and went off to live as a hermit. He firmly believed that money was the root of all evil, or at least most evil anyway. I guess the rest of the root of all evil was not being vegetarian, according to Crabbe. But as you can imagine, between the asceticism, between the giving his stuff away, between the hermetic seclusion, and of course, between, let's not forget, his very unusual dietary choices that were hundreds of years ahead of their time, plenty of people thought Crabbe was a bit mad. And he worked for a hatter for a while. So it could be him who spawned the phrase, but probably not. It seems a bit of a stretch, really. So let's talk about the second theory. This one is more of an etymological one put forward by some linguists. The word hatter in the phrase doesn't actually refer to one who makes hats. Not talking about a hat maker here. Instead, it is a corruption of a different word altogether. In Old English, the word atter, A-T-T-E-R, isn't talking about hats, is actually a term relating to snakes, like adder, A-D-D-R. You know, apparently atter in Old English meant poison, hence atter, snake, adder. Okay, fine, I can see that link, that makes sense so far. Although, as we all know, snakes aren't poisonous, they're actually venomous. So this translation is slightly missing the mark there. But the way to remember this, of course, is that if it bites you and you die, then it's venomous. If you bite it and you die, it's poisonous. And I guess if you bite it and it dies, then what are you doing going around biting living things, mate? Roger Crabbe would be very disappointed in you. Anyway, atter, in Old English, it means poison, apparently. And some extremely daring linguistic experts have taken this and gone on to forge a link between the words mad and venomous, right? Claiming that mad at one stage meant venomous. So if mad means venomous and atter means snake, then the saying becomes as venomous as a snake. So, I don't know how much water this holds, look, it's not the only etymologically optimistic approach, I guess you could say, that people have taken to explaining this, the origin of this saying. Because the word hatter, right, hatter apparently used to be a verb. Again, nothing to do with hats, apparently. It used to be a verb. It actually appears as such in Samuel Johnson's 1755 work, A Dictionary of the English Language. And in this dictionary, hatter is defined to mean to harass, to weary, to wear out with fatigue. Now, eventually, according to this this second linguistic theory on the origin of mad as a hatter, eventually, hatter became a noun, went from being a verb to becoming a noun. Now, this happens all the time. English is very good at verbing nouns, but it's also good at nouning verbs. It happens all the time. Text is now a noun as well as a verb, as is snap, swipe, flex. The list goes on. These are all verbs. I guess they still are, but also commonly used as nouns these days. So, if hatter, the verb, became a noun, it started to then mean someone who, I guess, was harassed to the point of fatigue. I don't know. Anyway, fine. I'm with you so far, right? The saying has become mad as someone who was harassed to the point of fatigue. And that makes sense. I'll grant you, right? I'd be pretty mad if I'd been harassed to the point of fatigue. But that honestly just doesn't seem all that catchy. It doesn't really seem like the sort of thing that would really take. So I'm not convinced by any of these theories we've talked about so far. Let's talk about the third and what I believe to be the actual origin behind this saying, mad as a hatter. One that involves, surprise, surprise, the actual hat-making profession, as it was in the 18th and 19th centuries. There's a medical condition known as erethism, right, that affects the neurological system, with symptoms usually including headaches, weakness, trembling, as well as significant behavioural changes, including irritability, sometimes delirium, hallucinations, memory loss, some pretty devastating consequences when it gets really bad. The sort of thing, sort of symptoms that could uncharitably be described as madness. Now, how do you develop erethism? Well, through exposure to mercury. The more mercury you're exposed to, the more likely you are to get erethism. And you may wonder, was there a reason that a certain type of person, say, someone involved in a certain profession, might be exposed to a lot of mercury over an extended period and therefore run the risk of developing erethism? Why, yes, there is. 18th and 19th century hat making, as it so happens. Mercury, which, as you may know, is a metal that is liquid at room temperature and also highly, highly toxic to humans. It used to be used by hatters to convert, I guess. I actually don't know the right verb here, but to turn animal fur into the felt that was used in hats. So hat makers used mercury all the time. They were always around it, always in contact with it. And obviously back then, occupational health and safety and also, you know, a full understanding of the toxicity of certain substances wasn't what it is today. So these poor hatters, they're slowly but surely poisoning themselves with mercury as they go about their business, with many hat makers suffering erethism and all of the terrible symptoms that would make them seem like they were going mad. In fact, in the US town of Danbury in Connecticut, a town famous back then for its hat-making industry, so many people developed erethism because of all the bloody mercury around. Erethism actually became known, it was nicknamed, the Danbury Shakes. In time, however, erethism took on a much more widespread nickname, Mad Hatter's disease, which it's still sometimes known as today. These poor, poor hatters, they're shaking, they're hallucinating, they're losing their memories, they're losing their grip on reality, again, uncharitably. They could be said to have gone mad, hence mad as a hatter. Now, thankfully, hatters these days don't use mercury, but the saying has stuck around, no doubt popularized by Carroll's immensely successful book, and, of course, the subsequent Disney film. And of course, in both the book and the film, the Mad Hatter's companion at the tea party, the March Hare, he also has an associated saying, the saying being, mad as a March Hare. And this one is a little bit easier to explain. Little bonus origin here for you. Aren't you lucky? I said that there weren't going to be any more. Well, look at this. I was lying to you. Here's a cheeky little bonus saying. But yeah, this one will be a lot easier and a lot quicker to explain. Mad as a March Hare comes from the fact that around March every year, European hares tend to go a bit mental. Why is that, you may wonder? Because March is breeding season. So, of course, little horn dogs are going to go a bit mad. After all, that's not the only saying to do with rabbits and hares and their breeding habits. If you're facing a tough tough situation or decision, if you've got something that, you know, you don't want to do, but you know that you have to, if there's something unpleasant that you have to go through that you'd rather just get over quickly, you might describe yourself as needing to bite the bullet. Allow me to put this into a sentence for you. For instance, I didn't want to sit and record a bunch of videos so I could set up social media accounts for my Tin Pot History podcast, changing my shirt between each one so it wouldn't look weird, but I just bit the bullet and got it done. Like, comment, subscribe, TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter now. Got to get those numbers up. You too could be one of the listeners leaving surprise comments saying that's not how you expected I'd look. And look, you know, I get it. If you don't want to go and follow the show on social media, you know, I wouldn't either. But maybe it's just something where you have to bite the bullet and get on with it, mate. Anyway, why are we biting bullets when we've got to get through something unpleasant? When we've got to do something we don't want to do? Well, this saying has quite an interesting historical origin, one that goes back several hundred years, as we'll talk about, although it is one that I will say at the outset is not as definitively proven as some of the other ones we're going to talk about here. This one is still a little uncertain. Centuries ago, before the advent of medical anesthesia, battlefield surgery was an extremely unpleasant thing to undergo. There were only a very limited number of ways that you could actually help a patient on the operating table or on the operating, you know, packed dirt floor of a triage tent to cope with the pain that they were going through. Before the 19th century, before things like chloroform came along, you really didn't have a whole lot of options. You had to make do with what was available. One, of course, was alcohol. Some patients would be given great big slugs of spirits before surgery began to get them, you know, sloshed out of their gourds before the knives came out so as to dull the pain and help them get through it. But another was giving something to patients that they could put in their mouths and bite down on or chew on so as to relieve some of the tension brought on by the pain and also to protect themselves, as we'll talk about, because in some cases, right, and I will warn you, this is about to get a little bit gruesome here. So for those of a more delicate disposition, you may want to hit that skip forward button a couple of times because we're about to get into the blood and guts here. In some cases, these things weren't so much given to patients as they were forced on them, right? Particularly in time-sensitive emergency surgeries. For instance, if a soldier had their leg blown half to pieces, they're insensible with pain, they're bleeding out, but the leg has got to come off, the wound's got to be cauterized, there's no two ways about it. The patient might have been held down by the surgeon's assistants, and then usually a piece of leather or a piece of wood would be forced into the convulsing patient's mouth, right, to stop them from injuring themselves by clenching their jaw with the pain, damaging their teeth, or even maybe chomping off their own tongue. Now, as I say, most commonly the things given to patients for this purpose were leather or wood, something tough enough to get your teeth into, but not so tough that it was, you know, going to do you any damage as you bit down on it to help bear the pain. But in addition to leather straps or bits of wood, it's thought that some patients were given bullets to bite down on in lieu of an anesthetic when nothing else was available. Now, this may sound absurd and also very dangerous, but it's actually, well, I was going to say it's actually, but no, it actually was dangerous, but not for the reasons that you're probably thinking. Let me explain. I'll admit to you again, there is a little bit of uncertainty about all this. It's not universally agreed upon that this sort of thing actually did take place, but there are enough historical sources that indicate that biting or chewing a bullet to deal with pain was an actual thing, even if it wasn't particularly widespread. But hang on. Okay, sure. I don't care about that, you're saying. Let's talk about the danger. This is a bloody bullet, mate. Firstly, it's metal. It's going to break people's teeth. And secondly, bullets are specifically designed to explode under pressure. So that's the whole point of them. What are people doing chomping on them? Well, we're about to... I tell you what, you know which word's coming next. It's everyone's favourite phrase on this particular history podcast. Well, actually, neither of those things are true, as it happens. Because firstly, right, the bullets were made of metal, certainly, but the bullets given to people to bite down on were made of lead, which, for a metal, is quite soft. You wouldn't necessarily want it as a pillow, but when it's lead versus your teeth, it's your teeth that will come out on top, certainly better than, you know, biting down on, I don't know, stainless steel. But even if it's not going to damage your teeth in that way, even if it's not particularly dangerous for your overall dental health, certainly isn't much safer in a different way. I said you wouldn't want lead as a pillow, and you certainly wouldn't, because lead, like mercury, is extremely toxic to humans. So putting a bit of lead in your mouth and chewing on it isn't that great an idea for your general long-term health. But then again, the people who were biting bullets probably had more immediate concerns about their, you know, short-term health to spend time worrying about lead poisoning. Okay, sure, fine, you say you'll accept that, but what about the explosive aspect of bullets? What about the, I mean, these things have been specifically designed to maim and injure and kill, so popping one in your gob and chewing on it probably isn't going to be a good idea, generally speaking. Well, I'm very pleased to say we've got another well actually lined up for you here, because when we use the term bullet, strictly speaking, especially in pre-19th century history, this term bullet, it actually means something very different from what you probably think it does these days. Because these days, we use the term bullet to describe what is actually a cartridge, which includes a bullet, but also has the casing, the primer, the powder, all in it as a self-contained, pre-constructed unit, right? So, you know, in a cowboy film, when you see someone loading their six-shooter with what you would call a bullet, what they're actually putting into their gun is a cartridge. But then over the years, as the distinction between a bullet and a cartridge has largely been arbitrary on every level other than the very technical, we've taken to describing a cartridge as just a bullet. Because, again, I would say the bullet, the projectile part of the cartridge, the part that actually gets fired from the gun itself, not any of the parts that make it fire, just the thing that shoots out, arguably that is probably the most important part of the cartridge. Without that, you've just got a firecracker, really. So it makes sense that we name the item after its most important constituent part. Anyway, in the time that we're talking about, right, before cartridges came along, very, very different situation. A bullet was just a lump of lead. It didn't have casing. It didn't have powder. It didn't have primer. It didn't have a primer. It didn't have anything else like that. It was just like a cannonball, really, right? It was like a cannonball being loaded into a cannon. It's the same principle, but obviously a lot smaller with pre-cartridge firearms. You would have to load all these things into it separately, one by one. You'd have to load the powder in, you'd have to load the bullet in, rather than it all being part of one neat little self-contained package in the form of a cartridge. These things, the bullet, the powder, whatever else, they were all separate items. So the point here is that when these poor soldiers who are, you know, having their arms and legs amputated, fully conscious with no anesthetic, when they were given a bullet to bite down on, it wasn't an explosive cartridge. They're not munching on a 50 cal round, right? They're being given a lump of soft lead, still dangerous to bite, but again, not for the reasons you might have initially thought, and certainly not dangerous in a way that these poor patients would have been worried about at the time. They weren't about to have half their face blown off by, you know, the explosive aspect of a bullet. Now, I don't know why it is that bite the bullet stuck rather than bite the leather. If it is indeed the case that patients were given things to put in their mouths in order to help them deal with the pain by clenching their jaws without, injuring themselves even further, I don't know why bite the bullet is what stuck rather than, I don't know, bite the leather. Leather does seem to have been more commonly used than bullets. But the first time the phrase bite the bullet is found in print as an idiom is in an 1891 novel by Rudyard Kipling. And maybe that helped to popularize it, or I don't know, maybe it's because bite the bullet is alliterative and bite the leather isn't. So maybe it's just a neater turn of phrase. I guess we could change it. What could we do instead? We could do what? If we want to keep the alliteration, we could do lick the leather. Oh no, that's got some rather more explicit implications, doesn't it? What about lubricate the leather, like with your saliva? Nope, that doesn't work either. Nope, same problem. Okay, you know what? Look, maybe we just stick with bite the bullet after all.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Here's a classic for you, one that you would have heard when you were a kid. It's not carrying on like a pork chop. That was a favourite of my dad's for some reason. No idea what the meaning or the origin is behind that. I don't know what it is about pork chops that carry on. I'm just thinking about back to all the times that my dad used it. I've never seen a pork chop whinging about being told to turn off a Game Boy. No, it's not carrying on like a pork chop. The phrase crocodile tears instead is probably one that you would have heard as a kid. And certainly during my time as a primary school teacher, I witnessed plenty of crocodile tears, let me tell you. Crocodile tears are, for those who don't know, tears that aren't genuine. Or I guess more broadly, someone expressing insincere sadness or sorrow. While kids are often the ones accused of producing crocodile tears, especially when using their special kid powers to cleverly manipulate hapless adults into getting what they want, crocodile tears aren't limited to just children. Adults can and do produce crocodile tears. In fact, the only thing that doesn't, it seems, produce crocodile tears are crocodiles themselves. But there is a persistent and, as it turns out, truly ancient myth that tells us that crocodiles weep when eating their prey, almost as though they're sorry they're doing it. So this is where we get the saying crocodile tears, right? Crocodiles, they're munching away and they're crying all the while, going, oh, they're so sad, boo-hoo, I'm eating this antelope or whatever. Oh, the poor thing, the poor delicious thing. Now, this isn't true. Crocodiles don't cry when they're eating, but the idea that they do and the consequent saying goes all the way back, if you'll believe it, all the way back to at least the first century CE and probably beforehand. The Roman historian Plutarch wrote about crocodile tears. He wrote a proverb about people who seek someone's death but then publicly mourn them after dying as being like crocodiles and their tears, in the sense that they are being insincere or dishonest with a display of sorrow. And the concept of crocodile tears entered the English language by the 14th century. Again, potentially earlier, but the earliest record we have of it in English is in a travel account written ostensibly by a bloke named Sir John Mandeville. Now, we're almost certain that Mandeville never actually existed, and he was a figure made up by a travel writer of some description. And this travel writer seemed to have made up a lot of the stuff that was written about Mandeville as well, because a lot of the stories associated with Mandeville are very clearly made up. They are fantastical in nature. But there are some truths written in Mandeville's travels here and there. But as you'll see from the tract I'm about to read to you from Mandeville's travels, it's all mixed pretty heavily in with nonsense. Here is Mandeville's description of the crocodile. In that country be plenty of cockadrills, that is, a manner of long serpent. And in the night they dwell in the water, and on the day upon the land, in rocks and in caves. And they eat no meat in all the winter, but they lie as in a dream, as do the serpents. These serpents slay men, and they eat them weeping. And when they eat, they move the overjaw and not the nether jaw, and they have no tongue. Now, he's got some stuff right. Crocs don't have tongue. Well, sort of. They do have tongues, but they're just fixed in place. They're actually melded to the bottom of their mouths. They can't wiggle their tongues around or, I don't know, French kiss like we can. But crocs certainly don't weep while they're eating, as we've established. But in spite of this, the myth has persisted that they do. And so the saying, hundreds of years old already by the time the so-called Mandeville brought it into English, the saying has stuck around. It made its way into Shakespeare's work, episode 203, get across it. It's in Othello, when Othello thinks that his missus is playing away. If that the earth could teem with woman's tears, each drop she falls would prove a crocodile. And that's just one of the countless examples of this saying taking hold in English. We of course, still use it today. But here's something really interesting, right? Crocodiles don't shed tears while eating, but they do shed tears. It's just that these tears are purely functional and not linked to emotion in any way. Why is this? Well, because apparently crocodiles don't even have emotions in the first place. I was told this when I visited Hartley's Crocodile Adventures up near Cairns, with a bloke who put in a show for us up there, told us that the crocs don't get cross or upset or angry when even when they rip each other's legs off or the like. But then again, this bloke also somehow managed to work in this weird anti-climate change rant while telling us about the great big croc in front of him. So I don't know if he's to be believed. Turns out he shared more than one great big croc with us. Anyway, while crocs don't have emotions, and while, you know, human-made climate change is a hoax, that's far north Queenslanders for you, they do produce tears. Crocs, that is. Not far north Queenslanders, as far as I'm aware. But as I mentioned, these tears, they're functional. They are designed to keep their eyes nice and lubed up when they're out on dry land. So crocs don't cry when they're eating. Instead, they cry when they need a swim, which was, incidentally, a favoured tactic of mine as a kid on a hot summer's day when I was trying to persuade my parents to take me to the pool. You may have heard a saying that runs something along the lines of, and if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. And if you have heard a saying like this, I certainly hope it wasn't because someone was saying it to you. Because if they did, they probably weren't being very nice to you. They were implying that you're a little bit gullible. But hey, look, honestly, there's nothing wrong with being gullible. Some of the greatest figures from history were extremely gullible. In fact, Albert Einstein himself once said, I have no special talents. I am only passionately gullible. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you, mate. Of course you didn't say that. Come on, mate. Maybe there's a reason people are going about trying to sell you bridges. I don't know. Anyway, why are we talking about bridges when it comes to gullibility? Well, this particular saying, it has its origins with a bloke by the name of George C. Parker. Parker was an American fellow. He was born in 1860. He grew up in New York City, and he ended up making a living as a professional con man. And he had plenty of targets for his schemes, too, as new immigrants arrived in New York City every day, hoping for their chance to find wealth and prosperity and fortune in their new home. And Parker would go after these poor marks. He would target them due to their, you know, naivety and their inexperience in the U.S., he'd approach them with the deal of a lifetime, the opportunity to buy one of New York's immensely famous landmarks. This sounds ridiculous, but it actually worked. He sold people the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Madison Square Garden, even the Statue of Liberty, apparently. But most famously, Parker would pose as the owner of the Brooklyn Bridge, and he would offer to sell it to unsuspecting immigrants. And for all these monuments, right, when trying to sell them, Parker would construct detailed false identities. He would pose as, you know, a government official or a wealthy businessman or what have you. He would forge all the paperwork that suggested that he was the legitimate owner of whatever he was trying to sell. And again, believe it or not, was very successful in flogging very famous, very public monuments and landmarks. Now, he got caught, plenty of times he got caught, sometimes even convicted of fraud. He was sent to prison. He was thrown in the slammer three times. But after each release, he clearly didn't learn his lesson because he'd go straight back to his old cons. And the Brooklyn Bridge scam in particular was a very lucrative one for him. More or less as soon as it was finished in 1883, Parker started trying to sell it to people despite not owning a single brick of it. I shouldn't just stop at trying. He did it too, the madman. He sold the Brooklyn Bridge time and time again, sometimes for as much as $50,000. That's $1.5 million in today's terms. These poor victims, right? They thought now that they owned the bridge, that they had the right to set up toll booths and extract money from all the people who used the bridge. And so they would go over to the Brooklyn Bridge. They'd attempt to set up a toll booth so as to profit from the new acquisition. And then the cops would arrive and tell the mark that they did not, in fact, own the Brooklyn Bridge and that the bloke who sold it to them was a con man. I wonder how sick the New York cops got of actually doing this. No, mate, you don't own the bridge. No, you're the fourth bloke this week. Honestly, how did you fall for it? I hate to break it to you, but you got to jog on, mate. Jog on, old son. Parker scams were so successful that immigrants arriving on Ellis Island were at one point actively warned by officials there that, generally speaking, New York's great monuments weren't for bloody sale, mate. But in the end, Parker was done a fourth and ultimately a final time, because under New York state law at the time, being convicted of a fourth felony automatically earned you a life sentence. And so, in 1928, Parker was locked away for good. He died in Sing Sing Prison in 1937. However, his legacy lives on in the saying, "I've got a bridge to set you." Indeed, the fact that this saying caught on as New Yorkers mocked one another in for their gullibility in honor of the gullibility of all of Parker's poor victims, this saying spread and actually undermined the whole scam. Parker and other con men were a victim of their own successes as people began to mock the gullible with this con and made people very aware of the fact that you probably shouldn't go around thinking you can just, you know, buy bridges off people. Anyway, as a career criminal, as someone who was in and out of prison, Parker probably never imagined the legacy that he'd have as the reason behind this little saying that he caused to spring into being due to him preying on the innocent and on the gullible. Just like, incidentally, Albert Einstein did. Before he became an eminent physicist, he was out there on the streets of Bern over in Switzerland scamming tourists with, you know, the little shell games. No, mate, of course he didn't. If you believe that, bloody hell, I've got a bridge to sell you. A dozen, as we all know, is 12 of something. Eggs, oysters, golf balls. Wait, hang on. Why is it that things with hard outer shells and delicious insides are always sold by the dozen? And listen, don't you sit here and tell me that the inside of a golf ball isn't delicious. Why do you think they make them so hard to crack open? They must be hiding something very, very tasty in there. If you don't believe me, go online. Go and have a look at the picture of an inside of a golf ball. Some very lucky people have managed to get them open and the inside looks extremely succulent. Anyway, sorry, we don't need to talk about how delicious golf balls are. That's an entirely different episode for us to get across. We're here to talk about a certain phrase to do with the idea of a dozen of something. Everyone you ask will tell you that a dozen is 12. Everyone, that is, except a baker. Bakers have their own system altogether when it comes to a dozen of something because, as the saying tells us, a baker's dozen isn't 12, but 13. Why? How can bakers get an extra little bonus in their dozen? Well, the answer to this is actually really, really interesting. And unlike some sayings and phrases we have where the origin might be maybe a little doubtful, this one is thoroughly explained. Hundreds of years ago in medieval England, there were very, very strict laws about the production and sale of bread products, as bread was a staple of more or less everyone's diet. The 13th century English law known as the Assize of Bread and Ale set standards for the price and the quality of, well, obviously, bread and ale, given how important they were to the average consumer. And so because of these laws, the weight and the quality and the price of bread was extremely tightly regulated by the authority. So no one got any ideas into their heads about, you know, being a bit shonky, ripping people off, cutting flour with sawdust or selling loaves at short weight. tell you what, we could use a bit of that sort of regulation these days, the bloody cost of living and shrinkflation and supermarkets posting record profits while blaming their flagrant price gouging on inflation, bastards that they are. Anyway, the penalties for breaking the regulations on the sale of bread were very steep indeed. You could be levied with hefty fines, or you could be bunged in the pillory, or in some cases, even cop a beating. Being flogged in public for ripping people off was not a good look for the enterprising baker, whose reputation would be in the bloody chamber pot if they were caught breaking the rules. Prices for bread were set. You could only charge so much for what you were selling based on how much wheat went into actually making the bread. Now, this would obviously be fine if you could predictably and consistently produce the same amount of bread from the same amount of flour, but as anyone who has, you know, maybe tried a bit of bread baking will know, it's never that simple. Loaves of bread will vary in all sorts of different ways, in taste, in texture, in consistency, but importantly for our story here, in size and weight. So, you bake your bread, you put it on sale at the regulated standard set price, and you sell your loaves by the regulated standard dozen. But what if your batch wasn't the best one you've ever made? What if the loaves came in underweight? What if the medieval equivalent of a Karen goes home, weighs her dozen loaves, and finds that they come up short? You're in deep poop, my friend. Even if it was an honest mistake, it is absolutely not worth the penalties and fines to be caught out like this. So, medieval English bakers used to throw in a 13th loaf so as to make sure that they definitely were in compliance with the regulations and that their bread met the minimum weight requirements for the price that it was being sold at under the law. So, you ask a baker for a dozen loaves and you would get 13 just to make sure he was in compliance. Hence, a baker's dozen, the saying actually goes all the way back to the medieval regulation of the food industry in combating fraud and misconduct. And it's not just the saying a baker's dozen that survived all of this. The assize of bread and ale remained on the books in England and then Britain until the 19th century. Such was the importance of bread to ordinary people. So, you can see that the term baker's dozen has a very long and honestly quite a rather more important history than you might have thought. If you've ever worried about the importance of availability of affordable bread to common people, just have a look at the beginnings of the French Revolution. But before we wrap all this up here, I want to share with you, this isn't necessarily related to the saying a baker's dozen, but I want to share with you my favourite joke relating to the concept of a dozen. It's not at the top of a very long list, admittedly, but it's still a great joke. All the maths nerds and the computer scientists will enjoy it at least. So there's this fella, right? And he's about to head out to the shops, about to head down to the supermarket to get some shopping done. But before he leaves, his wife stops him and says, hang on, can you grab me a litre of milk? And if they have eggs, get a dozen. And the bloke goes, yeah, no worries, that's fine, of course, not a problem. And he goes down to the Coles or down to the Woolies, whatever. Obviously, he shoplifts something at the self-checkout. Of course he does. We got to fight the price gouging somehow. But he gets home, right? He comes back to his wife and he presents her with a dozen litres of milk. And she goes, mate, what the bloody hell are you doing? What's with all this bloody milk? Why'd you buy a dozen litres of it? And he goes, oh, they had eggs. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. Those are the historic origins of five more popular sayings. And I'll tell you what, I hope you enjoyed this episode even half as much as I enjoyed putting it together. This one was a ripper to get across. So I hope you learned a thing or two and enjoyed yourself as you did so. But now we move to the boring housekeeping stuff, which will be dominated this week by social media chat. Heading back to social media after having been off it for so long has been fine, I guess. Quite seriously, it has been extremely heartening and very humbling to see how many people have headed straight over to, you know, Instagram, TikTok, whatever else, and followed the show. And there's been some very, very positive feedback from people who have been getting across the silly videos I've been putting up there. There's also been some very constructive feedback that has been sent to me. I particularly appreciate all the little tiny baby Zoomers getting in touch. with their advice as to how to avoid being cringe on social media. It's greatly appreciated. In particular, I want to thank alert listener Gemma Bartholomew, who sent through a terrific email about some of the best practices for TikTok. It was very, very helpful. So good on you, Gem. Appreciate it a lot, mate. But I also want to thank a group of listeners who made a certain type of comment on many of the posts that I was making. I found this very, very funny indeed. And if I could ask a favor of anyone who is following me on these social media channels, if you wouldn't mind following in these people's footsteps, because I thought it very funny and also, you know, maybe very useful, maybe very important. I want to thank alert listeners Sashat_73, Bryony_Anna86, Jack_Dante, 2 underscores for Jack, greedy boy, Alviba96, Brandon_Shawshank, just 1 underscore for Brandon, Exploding Titums, Arado, and Andrew Renwick, all of whom commented on various posts that I'd put up, all saying something along the lines of, give this man a book deal. So if you've got the time, if you've got the energy, and you'd like to contribute to, you know, what is very funny, but also may really be the thing that tips the scales, if you wouldn't mind heading over to the videos that I post and just commenting something along the lines of, you know, give this man a book deal. I'll let you know, you don't have to copy my homework exactly, or rather copy the homework of other listeners, but I think it would be very funny if, when I'm pitching to publishers, and, you know, for me to say, oh, I've got a very strong, active social media following, if all the comments are just people saying, give this man a book deal. I just think, oh, those publishers are going to come, like, all right, okay, I guess there's a strong demand for books. So, yeah, if you wouldn't mind doing that, I do think that would be very funny. But I want to address something else that's come up from social media, which I think I hinted at already throughout the episode. The fact that all these people are commenting, I didn't think you'd look like that. What did you think I'd look like? Did people have a very well-formed idea of the sort of person to whom a voice like mine should belong to? I understand that the moustache maybe threw a lot of people off, but I don't think my voice is that unsuited to the way that I look. And I'm not a spectacular looking bloke, but if you could let me know, then if you're tempted to post a comment saying, like, oh, I didn't think this is what you'd look like, tell me at least what you thought I would look like, so I can at least try to make some positive changes for you, mate. I don't want to ever be, you know, left in a position where I'm not fulfilling the needs and expectations of the listeners. So if you've got, I guess, some constructive feedback for my appearance, I'd love to hear it. And it was very amusing also reading all the comments from people who are a little more dialed into the wider Rileyverse, making comments about my little bald head or my tight jeans or my bookcase that I'm hiding. Anyway, all of those details I'll leave for less enfranchised listeners to discover by themselves, which you may do, my friends, by heading over to twitter.com/halfassedhistore. No Y, wouldn't fit, very annoying, and following me there as well as on TikTok and Instagram, wherever else you choose to, it's fine. Yeah, I have a background that, look, you can discover it for yourself. There's a whole realm of other stuff that I've done throughout my career that you may be interested or just very bored by. And if you would like to, I guess, get to know me a little more personally and hear me talk about other things that aren't history, you can have a listen to the podcast called, very appropriately, Have a Listen to This, which is the most undaring and cliched podcast in the world. It is just two white guys talking about whatever is on their mind. Me and my friend Dennis sometimes have conversations that are at least moderately amusing. So if you want to go and listen to that as well, it too is hosted by the good people at Acast. So yeah, you can get across that if you want to. It's nowhere near as good as Half House History. Dennis often tries to say that it is, but it's not. It's extremely mid, as all the Zoomers would say. Anyway, I also want to thank people who have been signing up on Patreon recently. I had a huge influx of patrons, so thank you very, very much to all the exalted patrons who have joined the ranks. The Ray F, Dave Kleiber, John Davison, Jenny Latham, Tom Gannon, Kai Miner, Sam Whitehead, Anna Margarita Nunez. Special thanks go to Cass R, who signed up at the highest tier. A truly a person of great taste and refinement. Thank you very much, Cass. And also, finally, Jonathan Cool, who signed up as a Patreon member. Jonathan is probably in the running as one of the people who could maybe one day unseat Eric Whedon as king of the email inbox. But you'll have to keep trying, Jono, because whew, old mate Weirdo's emails are something else. Anyway, thank you one and all for listening. Even if I'm not naming you in the end of the podcast, I certainly am deeply, deeply appreciative of your continued listenership. Something I certainly don't take for granted, and it was very touching to receive all the emails that I did from listeners after episode 300, which I understand people, broadly speaking, enjoyed. It was a very self-indulgent episode, but I don't know. I liked making it, and people seemed to like listening to it. So thank you for doing so, and thank you for letting me know what your thoughts were. If you want to share your feedback, or of course any topic suggestions, halfasshistory.net. Where you can find the contact form and also links to all the other social media platforms and the new merch shop. People have been getting across that as well over at the print bar, halfasshistory.theprintbar.com, where you can buy T-shirts, stubby holders, you can buy onesies, something else as well, mugs. And if you're in Australia, you'll notice the shipping is a lot more affordable than the old merch store. Old merch store still up for the time being, but probably will come down in the coming weeks. So head over there if you're wanting to get your hands on anything. Anyway, this has already been a very, very long outro, so I'm going to wrap it up here nice and quickly. Thank you very much for listening. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. Like, follow, and subscribe. Got to get those numbers up. Rookie numbers in this game. And I'll see you next week for more nonsense. In the meantime, leaving you with a question posed by Rapid Action Battalion. We talked about Mercury earlier on in the episode when we were talking about Mad Hatters. And Rapid Action Battalion wants to know, why is Mercury a liquid at room temperature but a solid when so close to the sun?
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.